How do I know what I think until I see what I say?
The Green Notebook, carried by military leaders around the world. Within those pages are sweat, tears, triumphs, and the hard-won lessons of life. Lessons worth sharing. Each week, the team dives into the notebooks of military leaders, business professionals, authors, athletes and coaches, and entertainers to share lessons and help you lead with the best version of yourself.
Today's episode is sponsored by Emblem Athletic, the best option out there for keeping your unit looking amazing with custom shirts, hoodies, and other gear. They're a veteran-owned business that specializes in making it easy for you. And if you've ever ordered unit gear, you know how difficult it can be. Emblem knows you have better things to do than design gear, collect money, and worst of all, sort through a bunch of shirts. Emblem takes care of everything, including, get this, free shipping worldwide. When it comes to something like a deployment shirt, you know you're going to have this for the rest of your life. So trust Emblem to deliver the best, guaranteed. Visit www.emblemathletic.com to get started with a free online store today.
Welcome to another episode of From the Green Notebook. I'm your host, Joe Byerly, and this week we're diving into the Green Notebook of P.W. Singer. In the first half of the 20th century, C.S. Lewis, the author of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, he wrote to a friend. And in this letter, he said that any amount of theology can now be smuggled into people's minds under the cover of romance without them knowing it. And what he was alluding to was the ability of storytellers to share important lessons through the power of narrative. And I would argue that when it comes to smuggling national security challenges into the minds of people through a story, nobody does it better than P.W. Singer and August Cole. In this episode, Singer talks about his latest book he co-authored with Cole, Burnin', a novel of the real robotic revolution. We discuss some of the technologies from the book, the difference between useful fiction and science fiction, and why he says useful fiction is like a smoothie packed full of intellectual vitamins. He also shares some of the lessons on teamwork he's learned from writing alongside of August over the last decade. So whether you're interested in how artificial intelligence will shape our future, or just looking to read a page-turner, I think you're going to enjoy this episode. So please welcome to the show, P.W. Singer.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming on. And maybe you can just start real quick by telling our listeners a little bit about yourself and what you have going on right now.
Oh, gosh. I think like everybody else, overwhelmed between work and family amidst a pandemic and an attempted insurrection. But when you ask what's going on, I wear a couple of hats. I'm strategist and senior fellow at New America, which is a nonpartisan think tank based in Washington that in particular looks at questions of where technology and public policy come crashing together. As part of that, I am, for New America, helping to put together a project looking at long-term remedies to the mis- and disinformation challenge to our nation. And literally just yesterday, we launched a major program to try and bolster cyber citizenship education in the United States, basically equipping our kids and long-term our nation as a whole with the skills to be able to navigate the online space more effectively, safer, et cetera, something that's available in nations like Finland that have built up resilience to these kind of online threats, but aren't here. We can talk further. We're also part of a project to try and get this out to the military. The other hat that I wear is I write books, and I think we're going to be able to talk about that. Most recently, did a book called Burnin' that looked at AI, but also past books like Ghost Fleet, Like War, Wired for War, you name it. And then finally, do a variety of consulting and new work, in particular, looking at the enterprise of what we call useful fiction, which is basically helping organizations engage with trends and technologies and forecasting in new, more effective ways, not just understanding them, but how do they communicate them? So a lot of different hats. My kids, it's tough for them when they're in school and someone asks, you know, what does your dad do? Oh, and I left out, I also teach a cybersecurity class at Arizona State. I even forgot one of the things I do.
That's awesome, Pete. And you mentioned the book Burn In, and I remember reading that when it came out. So for those who aren't familiar with it, could you talk a little bit about the book?
Sure. Thanks. Burn In is in many ways, a different kind of book in that it's the smashing together of novel and nonfiction. It's a techno thriller. It's set in Washington, D.C. of the future, of the near future. We follow a veteran turned FBI agent as they hunt down a terrorist who's trying to undermine the city, but also tear the nation apart. And through that hunt, however, you also learn about all sorts of questions of everything from, okay, how does AI actually work? What are the ways that everyone from Amazon to the US military to the police to toy companies are planning to use robotics? What are some of the political, legal, ethical dilemmas that we're all going to have to figure out? As an example, algorithmic bias. So what Burn-In is it's, you know, hopefully you enjoy it. It's hopefully entertaining, but snuck into it are over 300 of these lessons, along with the research in notes to document that it's not what August Cole and I, August is the co-author on it. We did the book Ghostfleet together. It's not what we dreamed up. It's actually sharing across that real world research. So in many ways, we joke that it's akin to what we do to our kids. It's sneaking fruit and veggies into a smoothie. You know, for some people, the smoothie, it's just the good taste. But along the way, you get the vitamins, you get the value. It's the same case here. For some people, it's just to enjoy the story. For others, it's an easy, ready way to understand these issues that they're going to deal with. But frankly, they're less likely to read an academic white paper or a memorandum. This way, they get the good stuff too.
I remember reading Burn-In and being like, I'm glad we don't have that technology. And then I'd look down at the footnotes and find out that it is a technology that is currently available.
We deliberately did not set a timeline on it. You know, sometimes when you read a book, you know, at the top of the chapter, it'll say like January 1, 2022, circa, you know, that sort of thing. We didn't do that because with both political trends and technology, there are certain things that you know are in motion. You know that they're going to happen, but you can't put a date specifically on, you know, when that technology is going to be rolled out. And we wrote the book before the pandemic hit, but one of the effects of the pandemic is, and that's probably why you had that experience, is that it accelerated the rollout of a lot of these technologies. It moved forward the timeline. You know, a great example of that is the opening scene of the book. It's set in Washington, D.C., and the character is talking to someone else. And then on the sidewalk, a little wheeled delivery robot drives by. And, you know, that seems futuristic. But that very system that, you know, we then have the footnote to show that it's real, that very system was actually deployed, so to speak, in Washington, D.C. during the pandemic. So it went from the plan to deploy to it actually was deployed. It's delivering groceries around DuPont Circle right now. And so, you know, we're seeing a lot of this move forward. It's sort of the pandemics, political crises, wars, like what we saw, what World War II did to technology. It can move forward the timeline in a lot of this.
How did you make the transition from writing books about technology to writing books about science fiction?
Well, so I'm going to do a slight pushback at you and say what we're doing is not traditional science fiction. And let me be clear, I love my science fiction, you know, both reading and, you know, one of the things we've been doing as a family during pandemic is I did my fatherly duty and got my kids addicted to Star Wars. So we're rewatching, you know, all the Star Wars and the like. But there's a difference between science fiction and what we call useful fiction, or sometimes the terminology is used of FICINT, short for fictional intelligence. So for us, it has to be grounded. There is a research element to it. So we spent 3 years researching, you know, everything from, to give you an example of the depth of research that went into Burn-In, I built an Excel spreadsheet that had in it the job automation projections from literally every single report that we could find from sources that ranged from the World Bank to Oxford University to McKinsey Consulting, you name it, what each of these and all their reports projected job automation would be overall, to how it broke down on specific occupational specialties. That Excel spreadsheet had over 3,000 different data points in it. That's not someone saying, ooh, I'm going to dream up, you know, what might happen, you know, something said in a galaxy far, far away. Or another, you know, example would be Burnin has a, you know, I don't want to plot spoil, so to speak, but it looks at the emergent vulnerabilities in the Internet of Things and how that means cyber attacks are going to change. It's a key lesson that the book is sharing, that the way we've been thinking about cyber threats has to alter. Well, the way we gathered that information was everything from threat reports to documentation of past hacks that have happened to interviews, you know, talking to someone who designed the water systems of major American cities and, you know, what worries you most, what things were, you know, not paid attention to during the design that scares you now. So that's where we differ, is both the hardcore research side and, going back to that notion of the smoothie, the deliberate use of the narrative as a means to share it. So, you know, science fiction is the milkshake. I love my milkshakes. The boring white paper is, you know, here, eat this vitamin. Hopefully useful fiction is that space in the middle, that smoothie where you can enjoy it, but get the good stuff. Our entry point into it originally, to directly answer your question, it started out on the entertainment side with Ghost Fleet. August and I had an idea of a story. We wanted to take people back to those early Tom Clancy books, that like Red Storm Rising, that we had enjoyed as kids, but that the market had moved away from. But we also were two people who came out of the defense policy world. You know, I'd written a number of nonfiction books. August had been Wall Street Journal defense beat reporter. And so we kind of couldn't help ourselves with Ghost Fleet. As we were building the story, we also wanted to share, you know, important lessons that we felt the community needed to hear. Two in particular, as an example, and it's funny to, you know, date it, but, you know, we started that project back in 2011, 2012. One of the key things that we were pushing was, hey, while, you know, the rest of the community is mostly focused on counterinsurgency and counterterrorism for good reason. And oh, by the way, the same thing is happening in the publishing world. Even the Tom Clancy books had all become about terrorism. That you had the rise, the looming rise of a great power with China, that we saw there would be competition, but that it would be a very different kind of competition than what the Cold War had been. So the way you might visualize a war with the China would be very different. Now, that all, you know, seems to make perfect sense right now in 2020, but that was, you know, against the grain. There was a lot of pushback when we start that. That was one of the nonfiction lessons of it that, you know, we couldn't help communicate. Another was somewhat related to that, is that that kind of competition, that kind of war, would see what is now become known as multi-domain, that, you know, unlike the battles in Afghanistan, that it would not just take place on the land, but you'd have action, air, sea, places we'd never fought before, like cyberspace and outer space. And then wrapped up within that was key differences. A big theme of Ghost Fleet was understanding supply chain vulnerabilities. Again, it's funny to, you know, talk about these now. You have been like, of course. Well, that was new. So that's the origin of Ghost Fleet. You know, it starts out more on the entertainment side, but we can't help ourselves. We also do this new strange thing of putting research end notes in the back of a novel, you know, to specify the rule that every technology, every attack in it is drawn from the real world. That was a big debate with a publisher. They're like, that doesn't happen in novels. And we're like, but that's what happens in nonfiction. And what happened is Ghost Fleet took off. It obviously did well on the, you know, summer beach read, but it also became, put it directly, the most influential work of our careers. You know, I'd written books that were, you know, on the military professional reading lists, and obviously had done a lot of stuff in defense policy. August had had front page news stories. Ghost Fleet trounced all of that. we got invited to brief its real world lessons everywhere from the White House to the tank in the Pentagon to, at this point, over 100 different military units and organizations, everywhere from the deck of aircraft carriers to JSOC, you name it. It led to all sorts of both known and less known policy changes. My favorite is the Navy literally calling a $3.6 billion ship program Ghost Fleet and giving me $0 for it, which, you know, makes me less happy. And so that led to the realization of this new realm that, you know, we call useful fiction, that it could be a means of both, you know, storytelling, but also sharing important, useful information. And that led to, you know, sort of two tracks. One, us now with Burn-In, we essentially selected a topic that we felt, a nonfiction topic that we felt was what is the most important but least well understood topic. And to us, it was just the massive impact of AI and robotics. And by that, you know, less understood of everything from, you know, how it works to the ways that it'll be used, et cetera. And let's take that topic. Let's use the means of narrative as a way to share that with everyone from public to key policymakers. And it was both a goal, but also an experiment. Could the magic of Ghost Fleet happen again? And we think it did. Obviously, you know, a lot of people have enjoyed the story, but what's been also pretty amazing about Burn-In is, you know, it came out in summer, it came out in the midst of a pandemic, the incredible tumult of summer in the wake of George Floyd's killing. This was not a great time to release a book by any means. I mean, even the warehouse that stored the books had to shut down due to the quarantine, you name it. But despite that, we've been able to share its real world lessons, not just with readers, but we were invited to brief the real world side of it. Again, it's only been a matter of months, but we've shared it with, you know, over 50 different military and intelligence community organizations from the US and key Five Eye allies, you know, whether it's CIA to British MOD. The rank ranges from, you know, West Point cadets to four-star generals to even members of the incoming cabinet. And I was able to at one point brief the new US president on AI and what are the things that it matters for the nation. And that all came out of a book project that's a novel, and maybe because it's a novel. And that's been pretty crazy, pretty amazing. So I think it validates the approach.
Today's episode is also sponsored by veteran-owned Alpha Coffee Company. Their premium 100% Arabica coffee is freshly roasted for a bold, delicious flavor. Alpha Coffee supports veteran charities and has donated over 19,000 bags of coffee to deployed troops. They also offer a combinable 10% military discount and 10% off for subscriptions. Taste the Alpha difference. Purchase their coffee today from their online store or via Amazon Prime.
Yeah, so Pete, you've done this useful fiction on your own projects. Have you done it for any other projects as well?
That's what's been so exciting. And one of the outcomes of books like Ghost Fleet and more recently Burn-In is other organizations began to approach us and say, essentially, can you create a Ghost Fleet, but for us, but for our topic, but for our issues? And so August and I began to do this in a lot of different ways. One example was the Norwegian military had a war game. And, you know, in the war games, you generate out lessons from it that are issued in a traditional report white paper. They asked us not to create the scenario for the war game, but rather on the other end of it, can you take those insights that we learned and turn it into a narrative that's more likely to be read? And what was exciting about it is their report on the lessons learned from the war game reached the level of a two-star. Our narrative was read all the way up by the Minister of Defense. In another example, we worked with, we've actually done this for a couple of entities, an intelligence community, an allied military, US Navy. They've got strategy papers. trying to communicate a vision for the unit. And we then took that strategy paper and turned it into vignettes that help communicate the real world themes and issues, literally the chapters, but in a manner that struck harder and helped people visualize and it was more likely to be read. And then the final thing that happened that was really exciting is certain entities came to us and said, we don't want you to, you know, create for us. We want to have the skills ourselves to do better at forecasting and communication. And so we began to create executive education courses first for, we did this with the Air Force with its Blue Horizons team, and then more recently with NATO Allied Transformation, and then with a training course actually for new One Stars. And essentially, it's not about us doing it, but providing the toolkit for here are better ways to do forecasting. And guess what? We are all futurists. Whether you are a scenario planner or you do budgeting and training, you're a futurist. You're making decisions about the future. So how do we do forecasting better? But also, again, whatever role that you're in, whether you're in acquisitions or infantry, you name it, you have to be able to communicate more effectively. And so here are some of the tools of being able to think about communicating in manners that go beyond the traditional ways that we have done it, that the research shows to be more effective. And so it's been really exciting to see other organizations take this kind of approach and utilize it. It's been fun for us to engage on all of these different topics.
Hey, Pete, one of the things I love about this interview, and as you're talking about Burn-In and Ghost Fleet and your useful fiction project, is you keep using words like we, us. And so it's a true partnership between you and August. And so what lessons have both of you learned over the years about teamwork and communication and relationships? Because you two are friends.
Yeah. The publisher jokes with us. They're like, you are the only co-authors that have come out of a project closer than when you came into it. And it's interesting because let's pull back on this. There's the narrative, the trope, the cliche of a writer, particularly if it's a fiction writer, a novelist, that it's a singular task that they, you know, go off with their typewriter to their lake house. And then 6 months later, they come back or, you know, it's whatever, Hemingway drinking himself or, you know, we all know that kind of trope. And yet in almost every other area of writing, whether it's writing software, to even in the realm of fiction, TV shows are written by a writer's room. Within bureaucracies, yes, you can write a memo, but the reality is in most bureaucracies, that memo, it either comes from a group working together, or certainly as it makes its way up a chain, it gets modulated. So we were like, actually, why is it strange for us to be a team? In every other realm, it plays out that way. Now, as a team, though, there's a variety of ways that, you know, we figured out how to work together. One is to drop ownership of ideas. So the way that we have likened our collaborative writing process is a little bit like 3D printing. So there'll be a design, a plan, an outline, and then one person will take that and layer on top of it, thicken it, but also cut, tweak, change, eliminate certain elements of it. Then the other person will get it, thicken it, cut, change, back, forth, back, forth. It's very different than a lot of collaborative writing process is more, you take chapter one and I'll take chapter two, and then we'll kludge them together at the end. With August and I, the drafts go back and forth and back and forth. And along the way, there's no sense of, oh, but that was my idea that got cut. I don't like that. It's mine. I mean, literally at the end of it, we can't remember who came up with, you know, that plot point or, you know, that turn of phrase. And there's actually a lot of it is kind of, you know, these magic moments of one person will start saying, you know, well, what about if this happens? And then I'll be, oh, I like that. But what about this? So what I've laid out is both kind of a process, but also there can't be a sense of ownership. I think baked into that is a sense of respect for each other's ideas. we also just, you know, genuinely like working with each other. We're friends too. Those, I think, are some of the lessons of it. We're also open to others' ideas and, in fact, seek them out both in the creation, but also in the, we might call validation, but it's the editing of it. So the creation side, you know, as I mentioned, you know, you're just not dreaming stuff up. You are going and trying to get material. You're doing the hardcore research. So that will mean, for example, interviewing people, and it, you know, might be interviewing that water system specialist, or for Ghost Fleet, you know, we interviewed a dogfight scene. Well, I spoke to multiple different fighter pilots. And so, you know, what is a move that you might pull if an adversary was in this position behind you? And so the result of that is that it has a realism to it. So when another fighter pilot, not just the public, when another fighter pilot reads it, they're like, yeah, that's the move I might pull too. So you're getting that input in the start, but also you're sharing it out with others to get, you know, I described it as kind of validation, but it's that reality check. It's that reality check. Like with Ghost Fleet, we gave certain elements to it. You know, one of the characters was a U.S. Navy ship captain of a LCS. We had U.S. Navy ship captains read those scenes, and they caught the, sometimes it was big conceptual things. Other times it was, you know, little tiny details, wording phrases. And so you have to be okay with that. Sometimes, you know, you have to say, okay, I didn't get that right. I'm going to take that concept. I'm going to change it. I'm going to tweak it. Or maybe it's, I got it right, but I didn't communicate it well. In military terms, it's red team, being willing to red team and not just do the red team, but modulate based on what the red team told you. So those are some of the lessons that have cut across it.
I remember when I was younger, I watched a movie called Total Recall with Arnold Schwarzenegger. And I remember in the movie, there was a scene where I think it was a cab driver that was a robot.
Glad you didn't bring up the infamous other scene that everyone who's seen that movie was like, we'll leave it at that. There are people who get what I'm talking about and people who won't.
Okay. So I said to myself, I wonder when we'll get to the point where there might be a robot driving a vehicle. And then about a year ago, year and a half before COVID, I was traveling to Tampa, and I was in Tampa International Airport. And I was on the train that goes from the airport to the rental car facilities. And the train is completely electronic, or it's not robotic. There isn't even a driver. And I thought to myself, we're at that point where I thought, oh my God, would we ever be there as a child? When I was thinking, you know, would we ever get there? And we got there and I didn't even notice it. It wasn't concerning that I was on a train with nobody driving. It was concerning that I didn't even notice the fact that it had occurred. So I guess a long way to ask this question is, are there any technologies that come to your mind that you are concerned about if they're implemented or if they become a thing?
Oh, gosh. Well, I think that's what Burn-In is very much about, is this idea of there are technologies that are already here or certainly soon to come that, yes, we should have concerns about them because of just how many thorny political, economic, legal, ethical, military questions they raise. So what I'm getting at is I'm not of the camp of somehow you can prevent them from happening. No, they're happening. It's more about the questions that they raise of not only what's possible that was not possible before, but also what is proper, the right and wrong ways to deal with them. And by that, I mean, not just legal, ethical, right and wrong, but to the military side, you know, what's the right and wrong doctrine? What is the right and wrong way to train related to this or organize around it? And that's where, you know, I'll hit a couple of the sort of key themes or lessons that cut through Burn-In. One is, just like you were talking about there, there's not this one specific moment where it's no robots, and then suddenly there's walking, thinking robots all around us. There's a transition. And that transition plays out literally over decades. And we are in the midst of that. And that means that you will have robotics of all sorts of different sizes, shape, forms, but also more broadly, artificial intelligence. And it'll be playing out in some ways that are visible to you. And you know that it is shaping the world around you. It might be a decision aid in your tactical operations center. And other times, it might be something that's playing out in the background where you don't even know that it's nudging you to take a certain action. You don't even know that you've been influenced by it. The same thing, you know, the size, shapes, and forms of the robotics, that also goes not just in terms of, you know, to use real world examples, a robotic 18-wheeler driving down the highway to a teeny tiny drone that is handheld, that you're, be it a special operations or police or a kid, is using to capture video imagery of something on the other side of the hill. It might be physical, that another part of it is going to be their own intelligence and their own autonomy. Some of them will be tightly lashed up to the human specifically telling it to do this, you know, the joysticking from afar. Other situations, it's going to be highly autonomous. So cutting through all of this is, one, this question of how do we deal with a new industrial revolution, an equivalent to what happened with mechanization in the 1800s and 1900s. And, you know, think about the effect of that on everything from war fighting to overall political ideology shifts. So mechanization changes everything from battlefield operations. You get the rise of Blitzkrieg, you name it, but it also fuels new ideologies. No industrial revolution, no fascism, no communism, which, you know, we then spend literally decades working our way through. We're going through the equivalent of something like that. As part of that, we also have this question that again plays out at the personal tactical level all the way up to the grand strategic, which is, what is human machine teaming look like? What are its forms? What are the best ways to approach it? So the question is not, are you going to have artificial intelligence? Are you going to have robotic systems? It's, what are the best ways to use them? And how does the human utilize them, relate to them? What is the effect on the human? And that human machine teaming is really at the heart of the story of both our world, our economy, our military moving forward. It's also the heart of the story of Burn-In. Hopefully, you know, we tell strangely through someone likened Burn-In to like a buddy cop movie, except, you know, the robot's the buddy. But so we try and use the book as a way to teach about human machine teaming.
Pete, thank you so much for your time today. And we enjoyed having this conversation, not only about useful fiction and Burn-In, but also just about the lessons that you and August have learned over the years of writing two great novels that I've had the privilege of reading. So thanks again, Pete, for your time today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Thank you again to all our listeners for joining us on another episode of From the Green Notebook. Check us out at fromthegreennotebook.com, where you can download past episodes, read some of our previous blog posts, and sign up for our monthly reading list and Sunday email. If you enjoy the podcast so far, please subscribe and give us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts. And follow us on Twitter at FTG Notebook, as well as Instagram and Facebook. You can find us by just searching From the Green Notebook. So this is Jacob Goronski signing off, and hope you tune in to our next episode. I came from the mud. There's dirt on my hands. Strong like a tree. There's roots where I stand. Oh, I've been running from the law. Hope they won't shoot me down soon.